Hello and welcome to the latest edition of China Inc. by Bamboo Word, where we discuss the latest business and financial news from China and what it all means. I'm Doug Yang, Bamboo Word's editor-in-chief, and I'm joined today by Renee Mangusky, one of our founding partners, who's also a longtime China watcher and former investment banker. Today we'll look at a major new U.S. move against Chinese electric cars. We'll also look at the passing of one of China's earliest mega millionaires, beverage tycoon Zong Qingho, whose story is a classic case study for foreigners of how not to do business in China. We'll start with the latest on a flood of Chinese new energy vehicles entering the global market and the latest step the West is taking to stem the tide. Many of our listeners will recall that the EU may launch an anti-dumping probe against Chinese NEVs that have been flooding their market, that they're worried that they'll put those local companies out of business. And now the U.S. is following suit, sort of, with Joe Biden's announcement of an investigation into whether Chinese NEVs could pose a national security risk. So we should start by pointing out that Chinese NEVs have already made a big inroads into Europe, while they haven't really entered the U.S. just yet. That makes Biden's move look a bit more preemptive than Europe's. How do you see this story playing out, Renee?
Well, there's obviously a difference between Europe and the U.S. Europe has been historically, well, if you look at the last 10 years, much more focused on climate change and renewable energy for power and also obviously for vehicles. So it's not a surprise that there were originally more open to the idea of getting electric vehicles from China imported in Europe, especially because the big European brands that we all know, Mercedes, BMW, Volkswagen, and so on, have been relatively slow at getting to the point where they could produce EVs at scale. And they're more expensive. So the U.S., on the other hand, has U.S. consumers have had a very different approach to cars in general, almost forever. But Tesla became very successful, in particular with people who were very focused on the environment. But for pretty much everybody else, people really focused on SUVs, and you know, the number of SUV sales that have been in the U.S. every year for the past 10 years is much larger than sedans, if you want, or cars in general. Mm-hmm. So the U.S. was always going to come out, I think, a little bit later. Now, for the rest, Europe was the first one, as you highlighted few months ago, to become very concerned that Chinese cars could be a threat to the European auto industry, in particular because they are producing cars, obviously, that cost less, in part foreign exchange considerations are obviously at play here. The RMB has weakened over the last year, 2 years, but also because they feel that all these Chinese EV companies are unfairly benefiting from government subsidies in China and so on. And that's pretty much how they're looking at it, and basically saying this is not a level playing field from a competitive standpoint, and if we let it happen, at scale, we're basically going to destroy our automobile industry in Europe and kill lots of jobs. The U.S. is not necessarily looking at it that same way, because Chinese companies are not exporting EVs to the U.S. But it's, you know, it's a little bit, I think, of a tit for tat, because the approach of putting it squarely on national security interests is pretty much a reaction to the way that China has looked at some of the Western brands, in particular U.S. brands. You know, months and months ago, the Chinese government decided that Tesla cars cannot go anywhere near a Chinese government building. Communist Party people were told not to buy iPhones anymore, not to use them on national security grounds. Same thing for Tesla. So, you know, I think what the U.S. is doing, I think that they're basically taking a page from the Chinese book, which is saying now, well, you know, these cars are going to be able to collect so much data about so many American citizens and so on, it's a threat to national security. Bingo.
We could argue whether that's legitimate or it's just an excuse. But anyway, let's go on to my second question, which was that the latest polls are showing there's a very real chance that Joe Biden could lose the presidency in November and be replaced by a second term for Donald Trump. Any thoughts on how this NEV story might evolve if that happens, and more broadly on how U.S.-China relations might change?
Well, I mean, on NEVs in particular, I assume that they would fall under his overall blanket statement that he's going to put 60% tariffs on everything that comes in from China. There's in the U.S. there's obviously a very focus at from the political parties on unions and blue collars, and in particular the auto industry in the U.S. and the thousands and tens of thousands of jobs and hundreds of thousands of jobs indirectly that it carries. So you could see very well Trump feeling that there's no reason to treat EVs differently from any other product, maybe even worse, in order to protect the U.S. Auto companies, the jobs, and relationships with the unions, and so on. So I think that that's how it's going to play out. I don't think, on the other hand, that Trump is particularly focused on, you know, green energy and electric vehicles as opposed to anything else.
He's not focused on unions either.
Well, no, that is not true, actually. At times, he's not happy with unions when they come out and they officially openly support Biden, but he's got actually a pretty good following among auto workers, if not necessarily the heads of the unions, but at least in terms of the individual workers in the auto industry in Michigan. So I think he's very sensitive to that. But I think he's just not as sensitive to these, you know, renewable energy things as much as Biden and the Democrats.
That's true for sure. Okay, well, I guess I don't think the road ahead for Chinese NEVs in the U.S. is going to look too good. But let's move on. Next, we're going to take a look at Zhong Qingho, who died last month at the age of 79. Now, many of our readers may not have heard of Zhong, but they're more likely familiar with his company, which is the beverage giant called Wahaha. Zhong was one of the first mega entrepreneurs to take advantage of China's reforms in the 1980s and 90s, and he basically built up Wahaha into this domestic beverage giant. And that helped Wahaha to attract France's Danone, or Danone, as a joint venture partner, providing a major feather in Zhong's cap. But the venture quickly soured a few years later when Danone discovered that Zhong, surprise, surprise, had quietly taken his newly gained know-how and used it to set up his own parallel company, which was directly competing with the joint venture. So, very made-in-China story. Anyhow, Zhong's passing really does seem to mark the end of an era, as we don't really hear too much about this kind of dispute between foreign companies and their local joint venture partners these days. What have the foreign companies learned from, you know, the last two or three decades, and What are they doing differently now to avoid this kind of conflict?
Well, you know, I don't know if they, I mean, they obviously have learned a pretty bad lesson. I'm not sure that there is much, you know, of a way that you can 100% prevent that from happening again as a basic principle. And let's remember that not so long ago, what was that, 3 years ago, I think, that the chip manufacturer Arm had a huge dispute.
Oh, that's true.
With with the head of its China business, who basically, with whom they had a disagreement, and he just left the premises with all the chops and basically said, good luck to you guys. They're bad people. In every country in the world, there are people who will always take advantage of other people, and companies that will take advantage of other companies if they can. So, you know, what's interesting about Danone in particular is that subsequently, or maybe at the same time, they also went into business with Mengniu, the state-owned dairy company, and they never had any problems there.
Right.
Volkswagen, many, many years ago, had a similar issue with one of their partner companies in China. So, you know, I look at that as isolated cases. You know, I think that there are people who will do similar things in, you know, many different countries. I think if you go back 100 plus, maybe 150 years ago, in the U.S., there were some unsavvy characters also that operated in business.
Right.
So, I would not make this a typical China problem. He was who he was, and that's it. I mean, at some point in time, he actually was the richest man in China.
Right. Well, and I was thinking too, you know, maybe exactly what you're saying, just foreign companies have gotten a lot better at choosing their partners.
Right.
They have a lot more resources to actually evaluate them. And, you know, before it was essentially like the Chinese saying, you're going to work with this company, you know, like it or not, or, you know, if you want to come here.
Yeah. But, Doug, you know, one point that I would like to make here is that, you know, I think it's a very interesting point. Is that, yes, Western companies became much better at screening out their potential partners in China. But, this didn't happen by chance. I mean, it was based on extensive research conducted on the ground in China.
Right.
With the national security law now, it is, I am sure, a lot more difficult to do that kind of due diligence work that was easy to do, let's say, until 3, 4, 5 years ago.
No.
So if you're a foreign company, especially if you're a smaller one, and you might be thinking about getting into China and needing a partner there, I think that that's you're looking at a very different landscape now.
Mm.
I don't think that you're going to be able to vet your potential partners the way that you could have done it before the national security law and this whole focus on, you know, foreigners as potential spies.
Right. Yeah. Sort of like Back to the Future. Hi, well, Song's passing also seems notable to me for the fact that you don't really see this kind of sort of very colorful entrepreneur, you know, another one being like Jack Ma, you know, sort of these, I don't know how you would describe them, you're just very, they say what they think, they, you know, they're larger than life and so forth. And you don't really see as many of these people emerging on the China business scene these days. Instead, it seems like many of the country's new mega rich are far lower key people, like ByteDance founder Zhang Yiming and Pinduoduo founder Colin Huang. What do you think has happened to people like Song, and you know, what does this say about the development of China's corporate culture?
Well, you know, I think that there were a number of Chinese entrepreneurs in, I would say, in the first 20 years of the reopening and the reopening and the beginning of economic growth. So you look at the 90s and you look at the 2000s. And he was one of them. I think he was probably the most visible one, but there were others.
Right.
And there were others at, the levels of larger companies as well as smaller companies. And over the years, I've met some of those people. The thing that is interesting is that those characters, as I would call them, because they were really characters,
right.
Were primarily people operating in what I would call the industrial sector overall. And many of them actually had acquired or bought divisions of SOEs that were not particularly productive. And when the Chinese government started to reform some of the SOEs, you fast forward, and then the next wave basically happened in the tech sector, right? And you mentioned Jack Ma and so on, and then you mentioned all the other ones that nobody knows about,
right.
Knows very little about. And I think that if you look at it today. And if you look at it for the last 3 years, very clearly, a lot of these people have been, I would use the term scared. I understand the meaning of the term, have been scared by what happened to Jack Ma.
Right.
and they basically decided that they needed to, take a much, much lower profile on one hand. On another hand, some of them decided that it was not just good enough to take a lower profile. They wanted out and they went to Singapore or they went to other parts of the world and to try and build businesses there. So, and so therefore, I don't think we're going to see another Jack Ma, at least not as long as we have the current political environment in China.
Right.
It is not possible. Now, some of them were by nature more humble, if you want, less flamboyant or whatever. Colin Huang at Pinduoduo is a perfect example. Colin was always, always low profile.
Right.
And I think that's just the way he was. Pony Ma at Tencent was also obviously much lower profile than Jack Ma.
Yeah.
But we're not going to see that again,
right.
For quite a while.
Not going to see another Richard Liu from JD.com.
Right.
He's another character. Hi. Right, well, let's wrap things up from there. Thanks everybody for listening this week. If you like what you hear, please tell your friends about us and rate us and share us on your favorite podcast app. And don't forget to join us again next week for another edition of China Inc. when we'll look once more at the latest trending Chinese business topic. Hope to see you all then. Goodbye for now.
Thank you all. Goodbye.